You are in the Senate Education and General Government Committee. If this was not your flight, please take a look at your flight plan and find out where you're supposed to be. Please turn off all your cell phone, Blackberries, PDAs, and all that stuff. If you do not, and I hear it go off, you will make a contribution to the Common School Fund because we need that in Oregon. I'm going to get started pretty quickly here. We're going to go out of order because Senator Devlin chairs a committee at 8:30, and we do not want him to be late. So we are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 392. I'll have Ms. Richardson explain it while Senator Devlin and my assistant, Allison De La Torre, come forward to testify.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 392 lowers the minimum age for required school attendance to 6. It would be applicable to children between the ages of 6 and 18 at the beginning of the 2008-09 school year.
Thank you. And Senator Devlin, we're going to give you the floor first so you can scoot off to committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to keep my testimony short here this morning. I could start off this testimony saying that I'm here to propose a bill to require all Oregonians to use seat belts. The first reaction you'd have to that would be, that's the law. Well, the reality is that is not the law. The law is that all Oregonians that have seat belts available in a vehicle have to be in seat belts. This is kind of analogous to that because I think most Oregonians believe that the mandatory age for children to start in public schools is 6, not 7. So the change that you're being asked to make here today, probably 95% of Oregonians don't believe you are making a change. I decided to support this bill with Senator Walker for a lot of different reasons. I mean, we could cite some of the commonalities where different states have gone, trying to meet the needs of children at earlier ages. Some of the statistics that I have, and I think that will be shared by Senator Walker's staff, are that 23 states already have their minimum age requirement at age 6. 9 states have the minimum set at age 5. But even more important than that, I think when you look at what we are doing in this building, the discussions we are having now, the discussions that we have had in the past, and all the emphasis that we have put on providing services to children at the earliest possible age, if you go back several sessions and you talk about our discussion about early intervention, early childhood education, you come to this session and the discussions that are occurring in terms of expanding Head Start to all eligible children. There's also a discussion going about moving from half-day to full-day kindergarten. There's discussions occurring about lowering class sizes in K through grade 1 or grade 2, depending upon your perspective. All of those discussions are centered on bringing kids into school earlier, getting them up to speed, ensuring that when they're past their early grades that they are reading at appropriate levels in the third, fifth, and then in the eighth grade. And I think this bill is just part of that entire process. I think for most Oregonians, like I've said earlier, you are not making a significant change. It's actually the way they believe the law is. I would hope that you would support this bill. I think it's probably long overdue. I know that the Superintendent of Education, Public Education, supports this bill, and I will get on to my committee and debate the very enlightening issues of the Department of Geology and Mineral Industry.
Madam Chair, that's a very important department, especially when we're dealing with emergency preparedness. I'm just
yes,
that
it
out.
Is. Thank you. Any questions? No, Senator, you've missed too many days. No more hall passes for you. Thank you, Senator Devlin. We appreciate your testimony. You're excused. We'll see you soon, and we'll hear next from my staff. If you'll introduce yourself, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Allison De La Torre. I am Legislative Assistant to Senator Vicky Walker. I was formerly Executive Assistant at the Children's Institute. That's a nonprofit dedicated to highlighting best practices in children's policy. And I have also served as an assistant preschool teacher. I would like to testify in support of Senate Bill 392, preparing our students through requiring classroom instruction at an early age during the most crucial window for brain development. This will help Oregon to close the achievement gap between disadvantaged students and their peers, and in turn reap significant benefits for our state. Experts in child development have long known the multiple and overwhelming benefits of early childhood education. In fact, 90% of brain development occurs before the age of six. Senate Bill 392 is an important first step in recognizing the importance of the early years of a child's life and the unpleasant reality that some parents are not motivated to send their children to school, whether it be public, private, or in the home, until they are legally required to do so. Age seven is tragically late in the game. Since Springfield first grade teacher Ann Goff could not be here today, I thought I would read a few excerpts from her powerful testimony that she sent our office. I understand what she is saying because I have also been part of the exhilarating and all-consuming experience of teaching a child how to read. Step by step and day by day, says Ms. Goff, first graders are becoming readers. Unfortunately, as it stands now, there is no way to require most of my first grade class to come to school. I, along with many other first grade teachers I know, are frustrated when we want to begin the truancy process to require attendance of a chronically absent child, only to find out that the law does not mandate his or her attendance. Therefore, there is nothing we can do beyond reminding the parent of the importance of school. Often that is not enough. Ann Goff says it is a huge disservice to allow a child to miss 30, 40, or 50 days of first grade, knowing the result will be a child who has learned so much less than what could have been possible. The students who skipped first grade in Ms. Goff's class will be impacted for the rest of their lives. Research clearly shows that children who start behind stay behind. In the U.S., children who fall behind in the first grade have a less than 13% chance of catching up to grade level. Nationally, 88% of children who had poor word recognition skills in the first grade were poor readers in the fourth grade. And a student who is not a modestly skilled reader by the end of third grade is not likely to graduate. A child's start has a tremendous impact on the kind of adult that they become. And starting early and starting strong, as you all know, it greatly increases a child's chances for success in school and life. In front of you are handouts detailing the compulsory school age in all 50 states. If you take a look, you will see that Oregon has fallen behind other states in this area. 24 states already require children to attend school at the age of six, including Florida, Arizona, Kentucky, and Mississippi. 8 states require children to attend school at age five, including New Mexico, Oklahoma, which also offers pre-kindergarten for all, and Virginia. And along with Oregon, only 15 states require children to attend school by 7 or 8. We can do better. We must show our children and families that Oregon is a state that values our educational system by passing this common sense reform. It's supported by best practices and sound research. Most importantly, this bill is meant to impact the at-risk children who need its protection most. We cannot forget that education is the great equalizer. It is my responsibility and yours to act to make sure that Oregon's children are legally entitled to the early and strong start in life that they deserve. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. De La Torre. I could not have done better myself. I'm very proud of you. Are there any questions from the committee? Senator Cruz.
Yeah, just thank you, Madam Chair. Just the confusion. Mm-hmm. So if a student doesn't start school at age six, if the parents, for whatever reason, decide to hold them back at age seven, do they start in the second grade?
I think that they would probably start in the first grade. I don't think that they would be forced to move up. I think that entrance requirements and, you know, they test the children when they enter.
And I think Senator Cruz will have the department answer that question.
Okay.
I think they'll be up to testify next.
Okay.
Thank you.
But I think she has the correct answer, but we'll
find out. Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you, Allison. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm going to call up Pat Burke from the department now, and he can answer that question as well as give us any other data or material they wish.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm Pat Burke. I'm the Chief Policy Officer at the Oregon Department of Education. Appreciate the opportunity to testify on 392 this morning. Specific to your question, Senator Cruz, it would be expected that a student would enter the first grade. It has really, at that point, a lot to do with preparing students for third grade benchmarks and ensuring that students have adequate periods of time to cover the first and second grade material and the beginning third grade material on which students are first assessed by our agency. We want to be able to give students an adequate amount of time to cover that material. Likewise, a student who, one reason or another, might not move into first grade from kindergarten, there are a variety of reasons that that might happen. That student the following year is expected to enter first grade, not second grade. So we would expect the student to enter first grade at age 7. I appreciate the opportunity to express our support for Senate Bill 392. This is a high priority by the state superintendent. The current minimum age means that students theoretically can be kept out of school until the beginning of second grade, and as you have already heard, and I won't belabor the point, this is very valuable instructional time for children. This is the time when early literacy skills are formed, early numeracy skills are formed, language development, early writing, early reading, early physical development, early scientific concepts, and of course socialization skills. And these are all critically important skills in keeping a student out of school. Denies them that opportunity for critical instruction. Obviously, one of the questions is, what's the potential cost of this, or is there a potential cost of this? We have looked at the enrollment data. We do not find that it would be a major change for school districts in their existing enrollment. And let me say a couple of caveats about this. Early childhood programs are not mandated, as you know, kindergarten or pre-kindergarten programs, either full day or half day. The school districts are mandated by the legislature to offer kindergarten programs, but because of the minimum attendance age, students are not required to attend them. Likewise, there are many private preschool and kindergarten programs, some through employers, some through churches, some through private enterprise. So it's very difficult for us to have a comprehensive database of all of the state's 5- and 6-year-olds. So what we did is we looked at first grade to second grade enrollment and second grade to third grade enrollment. There are approximately 41,000 first graders in the state. Now, if there were large numbers of kids coming into second grade being withheld at first grade at age 6, you would expect to see a large bump in enrollment from first grade to second grade. We do not see that in the data. We see approximately 41,000 second graders in the data, which tells us, which we have suspected, is we have a fairly good capture rate of first graders into the system. So we don't believe that this represents a major financial hardship, either in capital costs or in new staff for most of our school districts. Students would still be allowed to be homeschooled or to participate in charter schools that offer first grade programs. There is no change in the legislation there. If a student was being homeschooled and this was changed, we would expect that the homeschool student would be registered as they do now. A major potential benefit of this bill perhaps talks about a worst-case scenario, but we believe is an important point to make, is that this does give law enforcement and other agencies that work with families an additional tool to intervene if children are being kept out of school. Obviously, the sooner we can intervene in situations like that, the sooner we can get children in school, the better. And finally, Madam Chair, I would say that this is currently the common practice in Oregon school districts to offer first grade and to expect first grade age children, that is children by the age of 6, to be in school. So again, we don't see this as a major change, and it offers some considerable benefits. So we urge your support for the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Burke. And you did answer sort of two questions that have come up in email. We've gotten an inordinate amount of email that all seems to be saying the same thing.
Yeah.
In fact, it's actually the same exact email, just a different sender each time. And it says this will increase costs to taxpayers and that this takes away a parent's choice. The parent still has a choice and to homeschool. The parents still have a choice here to homeschool. They still have a choice to take their child to private school. They simply have to start educating the child at age 6. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Great. And then you've answered the part about the expense to taxpayers. There doesn't appear to be any that the schools can absorb any extra children that are not coming. I think mostly what this is a tool. Ms. Goff is a first grade teacher in my district in Eugene, and she wrote an email that the committee has a copy of. And her problem is just there was no way to enforce, and many first grade teachers see this, there's no way to enforce a parent to bring their child to school until that child actually turns 7. So this child was way behind, and it took about 2 years for this child to catch up to the other kids. Okay. And that's really what this does.
Madam Chair, as I mentioned, I agree with that, support that. It is a very valuable tool as we work with families and with children. It gives us one more lever to intervene for students who need that help.
Great. Thank you. Question, Senator Cruz?
A couple, Madam Chair, because I'm confused now, because when you answered my question, you said at 7 they would start in the first grade, but in your testimony you said they could start at second grade. I'm just wondering how that could happen. You talk about them being behind. Clearly, if they don't do first grade, they're going to be behind. But I guess I'm having trouble understanding how, whether they start first grade at 6 or 7 necessarily puts them behind. And quite honestly, some kids mature faster than others. There's probably a lot of kids who at age 5 would be ready to handle first grade, and clearly some, maybe at 7, are still having maturity issues as far as being able to handle it. So I guess I'm having trouble understanding how starting first grade at 7 puts you behind.
Right. Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, let me provide a little bit more detail.
Okay.
Most school districts would have, in a case like this, if the student had not been in school anywhere, had not been homeschooled in a preschool, the student had simply not been in school, then most districts, I believe, would place that student in first grade.
Okay.
However, if a student is coming in having had other experiences, even though perhaps not in a school, for example, if they had been homeschooled and not in a formal school setting, in those cases, the school district, I believe, would give credit for that prior experience and place the student in second grade. My remarks were specifically directed at a student who has had no exposure to schooling. That kid shows up as a 7-year-old. In many cases, it's hard to say most, depending on the staff available at the district, there would be some attempt to do some preliminary assessment of the student, some school readiness types of activities, to determine the best placement. I believe that what you would find that most districts, if the child has had no prior school experience, would still place that student in first grade. It is far better to make sure early that a solid foundation is made rather than to move the student into more complex material and have them always behind.
Madam Chair, I'd agree with that. I think it would be probably unusual for a school to make the determination that a child with no education basis at all would start higher than first grade, and as far as those who would be homeschooled or whatever and then move in, I can understand that, but this bill really doesn't impact those kids.
That's correct.
This bill is just impacting those who have had nothing, right?
That's correct.
And I guess, Madam Chair, one question would be, okay, I'm a parent, I've got 3 kids, and I've made a determination that child 2 is not as advanced as child 1 was, and I think it'd be appropriate to keep them at home another year, and then they'll be more ready to actually enter into the system, and this would prohibit my ability to do that, wouldn't it?
No, because you could homeschool your child.
But I didn't want to. I didn't want them to be public school. I just don't think they're ready.
Well,
but I no longer have discretion with this bill, correct?
No, I disagree, Senator Cruz. I think that you can put your child in school at 7 if you wish, but you're going to have to homeschool the child at 6. You're going to have to say to the state, I'm going to homeschool. And you do. And then your child enters the system at 7. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Thank you, Mr. Burke.
The bill, that would be correct.
Okay. Senator Morris, you have a question.
No, I'm really confused.
Okay.
If a parent chooses to just say, I'm homeschooling, then what is the purpose of this bill? The parent would still have that choice to hold the child back.
The purpose would be if a parent enrolls their child in public school and the child doesn't attend because the parent doesn't ensure that the child gets to school, then the school district can say, the law says you must have your child in school. And unless you file a home that you're homeschooling, a plan that you're homeschooling, then your child must be in school. Mr. Burke, maybe you could clear it up.
Correct.
When a parent homeschools a child, what do they have to do?
They have to register that fact with their local education service district. And in this particular case, by third grade, they have to participate in the state's assessment system. But the primary responsibility, if they're going to homeschool, is to provide that registration through the ESD.
And do they have to provide an education plan or any evidence that they are actually homeschooling the child?
No.
All right. Does that answer your question, Senator Morris?
The concern is that the parent, does this law remove from the parent the ability to make a choice that's in the best interest of the child? And I guess I would ask you kind of rhetorically, Mr. Burke, is it possible that it's in the best interest of the child to hold a child back, say a child that's born on September 4th, and is really not ready, physically developed or whatever issues may be present, is it possible that child is better served by waiting a year? And then, and if that's the case, then how does this law affect the choice of the parent? That's really the issue as I see it here, based on the hundreds and hundreds of emails that we've all received.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I would disagree with that. I don't see this bill as interfering with parental rights. The parent may still homeschool, and the parent, I think, has basically the same rights they have under current statute. The difference here, I believe, is not so much for the parent who is already homeschooling or is actively engaged. One of the advantages, as I said in my testimony, is this provides a very important lever for those parents who are not that engaged and who are neglecting the educational needs of their children. I also find, and I could speak to this personally, in my own experience with my own children, there is potential benefit from not moving a student from kindergarten to first grade and having the student take an additional year. That's what we did with my son for a variety of reasons. Turned out to be an excellent outcome for us and for my son. He was a late five-year-old, a young five-year-old, and was not completely ready for first grade. And on the recommendation of his teacher, he went into what's called a junior primary program, which is a year in between kindergarten and first grade. He was small for his age, and that extra year made all of the difference. He had an outstanding school experience, and I think that early extra year was very helpful. And I appreciated having that opportunity through the school district, and this bill does not mandate that the student be placed in first grade. It mandates that the child be in a school setting, homeschool, charter school, or public or private school setting, by age 6. So in my view, it does not remove the rights that parents already have.
Thank you, Mr. Burke. One more question, Senator Metzger.
I want to go back to a couple of things you said earlier, is that in addressing the fiscal question,
yes,
that looking at your second grade attendance level would seem to indicate that it was not significant in terms of the differentiation of number of students to indicate that there would be a sudden influx.
Okay.
So using that assumption, I would deduce from that that we're talking about a small number of kids.
Correct.
That don't, even without the authority, their parents put them in first grade. So I think what we're really looking at now is that subset of kids, and that is, you know, why is it that that small subset, you know, is not in school? Is it because some of the comments that were made that, you know, parents have made a choice and that they just want to give another 12 months and those kids do show up, you know, in first grade, but you're, you know, older? I mean, I think that's one thing to decide. This, and you had an example with your own son, and of course you, one advantage you would have because of your expertise being involved in education, you know those different things that are available. Probably not all parents would, you know what all those options are, other than maybe my child isn't ready. I guess I'd be more concerned if they didn't show up at age, you know, seventh and, you know, and turned to school. In terms of parental neglect, it would seem that if they show up, then and not necessarily parental neglect, that it may have been actually a conscious decision. And I guess my only question right now for you, just to, from a philosophical standpoint, and I just don't know what the right answer is here. You know, we've worked really hard on early childhood intervention and providing opportunities, and this committee has heard some of that. We'll hear more on those with Head Start, with kindergarten. And, of course, those aren't required either. We're trying to provide those opportunities because we do know that early intervention is best for kids. But, you know, is there, in your own professional judgment, is there a certain age, either with Head Start or kindergarten or first grade, at what level is it that we should mandate those kids get started? We want to provide the opportunities. You know, we believe they should start as soon as possible. But when is the magic time in which you say you have to choose one of those choices, do you think?
Madam Chair, Senator Metzger, it's a very good question, and there's a lot of debate about that very question. What the research indicates is that for low-income and language-deficient students, I'm talking about students for whom English is not a first language, there is fairly clear evidence in the research that starting at 4 with essentially a half-day program or a preschool program has lasting benefit. And by lasting, in this case, I would refer specifically to, do we see that through the third grade? The benefit of all-day versus half-day kindergarten is widely debated. Again, for low-income and language-deficient students, full-day kindergarten in the research appears to be superior to half-day kindergarten. And the general benefit of kindergarten, or a five-year-old program, has been fairly consistent in the research for a number of years. So my initial answer would be four-year-old programs available for students particularly at risk of not doing well in school, and certainly starting school at age 5 is something that I would strongly recommend. Now, what we the difference here is one is fiscal, in that moving school districts under Oregon law are all required to have kindergarten available. Students are not mandated to attend kindergarten. I would not personally recommend changing that, because I do think there are benefits that families enjoy by having a kindergarten program through their church or their employer or other avenues. But I do think having a variety of approaches where students can get education services as early as age 5 is a very good thing to do. The obvious question on going half day to full day is certainly a fiscal question that has additional teacher needs and additional capital costs with classrooms. So that's something that I think needs to be looked at more carefully. But I would certainly recommend early childhood programs by age 4 for those students in need, and a good kindergarten program by age 5.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The correspondence that I've received, and I suspect all of us have received,
oh, yes,
there is a common theme in that this becomes an arbitrary law that displaces parental choice in terms of the parents deciding what's in the best interest of the child. And just on face value, when you think about it, you know, that may be a valid concern. But what I've heard in this discussion is that, in fact, those parents that do care about their children can still make an informed choice and hold them back and homeschool. But what this bill does, it reaches out to those parents that are callous and indifferent and children that possibly are at risk to bring back into the system that really are ready. So, Madam Chair, I came to this hearing in one place. I'm in a different place listening to the discussion.
Well, thank you. That's good to hear. That's why we always have these conversations. And then we have three people who are signed up to testify in opposition, and we'll hear from them, and we'll see if you stay where you are right now. If there's no other questions, Mr. Burke, thank you. If you'd just stay in the audience, that would be great. I have three folks to testify. We're now running behind schedule. I'd like you all three to come up at one time. You'll have 2 to 3 minutes apiece. Roger Williams, Kevin Starrett, and Sal Casucchio. I hope I did that correctly. Just have a seat, gentlemen. Introduce yourselves and start in so we can get started.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Roger Williams. I'm the legislative coordinator for Ocean Network, which is a statewide homeschooling organization. I would like to have the opportunity to fill in some more flesh to what you've heard. Evidently, there was some uniformity to it, and I don't think that's a reason to discard the points that were made. This is really... I've heard the kind of the poo-hoo that this is not about parents' choice to do what's best for their children, and that anybody who doesn't want to send their child to school can just homeschool them. Quite frankly, we don't think that everybody is prepared for that responsibility, and yet they can still recognize that their child is not ready to be put in an institutional setting, a formal education process, and that it would hurt them, the child. Basically, this bill does, I thought it was very interesting, Madam Chair, that you said the purpose was to prevent truancy where that the child is put in the school, taken out. I know it hurts the school performance stats, and it's frustrating to the staff because they have to deal with in and out. But the proper way to handle that is not to punish, not to endanger the children who are too immature to go into a public school setting at age six. The proper way to handle that is to deal with those particular parents who are abusing the system. Maybe you can put put something into law that says if there's a pattern of in and out and in and out, then the child is declared to be truant, something like that. That does not impact those parents who are acting in a responsible manner for the best interests of their children. This is not about providing services. This is not about being legally entitled to an education. That's already in place. This is about forcing people to put their child into a public school or a private school where they actually have to pay money, extra money, to comply with the law when they're trying to protect the well-being of their children. I'm open to questions.
All right. Thank you. Well, I'm going to hear from the others before we open it up to questions. So who would like to go next?
Members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Starrett. Mr. Williams covered a couple of the points I wanted to make about two words that were used here a lot, choice and force. And, in fact, this bill does take away choice. There's no other way to describe it. It takes away parents' choice. And members of this committee themselves have talked about their inability to force people to send their kids to school at an earlier age. And that's what this bill does. And the way I see this bill as a parent of a 7-year-old,
It's really nothing more but an attempt to expand the power of the revenue of the teachers' unions and the public school establishment. And I gave you a little handout, the first pages of which are a recent OEA email. And if you look on the second page of that, you'll see a promotion for a President's Day education rally in Salem. Now, I'm the lucky recipient of OEA emails regularly, and it's interesting that the vast majority of them deal primarily with how much money the OEA can acquire. But in this case, they're talking about a rally for President's Day. And although you can't obviously see a hyperlink on a paper page, if you go to the rally webpage hyperlink, it takes you to a list of sponsors that the OEA is involved with, one of which is the Oregon Bus Project, which, as you well know, is a militantly left-wing organization. And I provided for you one page off their website from some months ago. And I think you can see that it's not something you'd necessarily want to share with your children. This is who the OEA is affiliated with. These are not the people I particularly want to turn my children over to, and the attempt of this bill to force people to do it at an even earlier age is really nothing more than that. If there are, there may be some people, and apparently there are plenty of people, who think it's a fine idea to turn their babies over to a government establishment at earlier and earlier ages. But I don't believe that it's the business of government to compel them to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Starrett. That was rather interesting testimony. I wondered if you were going to get back to the issue because I couldn't figure out where we were going with the militant left-wing organization. But I appreciate your testimony. And Mr. Casuccio, is that how you pronounce your name?
Yes.
Casuccio, excuse me, sir. Could you come forward and testify?
Okay, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sal Casuccio. I reside in Gresham, Oregon. And I'm also a board member for Home Education Liberty Project. I strongly oppose SB 392. SB 392, as everybody knows, would require all children to be in school once they turn 6 years old. Lowering the compulsory attendance age erodes the authority of parents who are in the best position to determine when their child's formal education should begin. It would restrict parents' freedom to decide if their children are ready for school. Another significant impact of expanding the compulsory attendance age would be an inevitable tax increase to pay for more classroom space and teachers to accommodate the additional students compelled to attend public school. And I don't know where, you know, the people in favor are getting their facts, but, you know, history is a good education of the future, and the high cost, this is from a group of attorneys for the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, and they're expanding the number of children, is required to attend schools increases the state education costs. In Alabama, in 1991, the Alabama Legislative Fiscal Offices estimated the cost of the change to be at least $4.7 million that year. In 1998, when Connecticut considered lowering its compulsory attendance age, a State Department education representative testified it required 13 new classrooms, while it would need 20 additional classrooms. You're also talking about hiring more truant offices, more teachers. The fact that you're not looking at the added cost of that or turning a blind eye to that is not really a good idea to make an educated decision. Also, many education experts have concluded that the beginning of a child's formal education too early may actually result in burnout and poor scholastic performance. And I know you want to keep everything short, so I have my sources are available upon request. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'll take any questions at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Casuccio. I appreciate it. Does the committee have any questions of either of these gentlemen who testified? All right. Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate your testimony today.
Thank you.
Senator Morris, are you still, have you?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate the testimony and the comments and the correspondence that we've received. But it seems to me that the conscientious parent that's wanting to do what's in the best interest of their child is not precluded by this law from making that choice. based on what we have heard. And if that's being the case, the parent still has that right to make that choice to hold a child back and choose to provide that home setting for that early education, as opposed to being arbitrarily forced to bring that child into the classroom. So I see the common theme of all of this correspondence is that parents are no longer allowed to make the choice in the best interest of their child, and I don't see that this law, in fact, does that.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, may
yeah,
I respond to that?
Yeah, you can respond to that.
Senator Morris, I appreciate those comments. However, even considering that, which obviously I disagree with, you know, the state already has a strained budget to, you know, let's say this costs $5 million per annum. You know, is that something that is in the state's budget to, you know, to include? I mean, we're, you know, $5 million is $5 million. I don't know what the figures are, the proposed figures of what it would cost here, but here's a couple of states, for example, and I would, it seems to me that $5 million can go to other programs or other, or back into the general fund to help the state out, you know, increasing strained budget. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pisuccio.
Could I provide just clarification for the public that may be listening?
Correct.
This is a policy issue, and as often happens, and always happens, actually, when there is a major fiscal impact, it's then referred, and Ways and Means will then review that and factor that in the priorities for the budget. So this bill may, in fact, if our legislative fiscal office determines that there is a significant fiscal impact, it may wind up in the Ways and Means process to address the very issue that you're talking about.
Madam Chair, may I respond?
Very briefly, sir.
I have two questions. If a child is held out and so-called homeschooled, then are they put in the second grade when they're seven or the first grade? And the second thing is, do they then have the homeschool law now states that the child is tested at end of grade 3, 5, 8, and 10? Will that mean that parents are forced to test their children a year earlier at the 3, 5, 8, and 10 grade level? Those issues do impact homeschoolers and those who you would basically force to homeschool here. I'd like to know that, or at least you should know that before you make a decision.
Thank you. I believe Mr. Burke testified about what age children would start attending school, so that question has already been answered. I'm going to close the public hearing. Thank you all for attending and testifying today. I could move this bill today. In fact, I'm going to open a work session on this bill today because I think the comments have been laid out here and we know where we are, and I understand there's some thoughts about which way people would like to go, but I would like to open a work session, and I would like a motion on this bill so that we can have a discussion and then decide what we want to do today. And Senator Cruz, I know you don't support the bill.
Okay, Madam Chair, I will make the motion for the purpose of discussion.
Thank you. You will make what kind of motion?
Well, I would move Senate Bill 392 to the floor of the Senate with a no-pass recommendation, or in this case, do pass. So.
All right. Senator Cruz, as his duty as vice chair, has moved Senate Bill 392 to the floor of the Senate with a do-pass recommendation. Is there discussion on this bill? And I know Senator Cruz is a no.
Yeah.
Do you want to discuss that?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly, I guess I take some issue with some of the assumptions here that those parents who choose, for whatever reason, to delay their child from entering the public school system, and they make a determination that at age 7 they're better ready to be in first grade than at age 6, with this bill they would have to be homeschooled. in that year, and quite honestly, there are a lot of parents that don't have the inclination or the time to do that. And so basically the discussion we heard here was that good conscientious parents, if they hold their kids out, will homeschool them, and parents that don't do that are not good conscientious parents. And I strenuously object to that generalization. I don't think that's true. And you know, because if you're in a family where both parents are having to work, how are you going to homeschool? I mean, homeschool is a very, very unique situation, and at least one parent has to be incredibly engaged to make that happen. And when both parents are working, that becomes really, really rather difficult. And I do think there are obvious cases where a child may be better off waiting a year. And I think the advantage in the current system is because they aren't homeschooled, then they start at first grade. What we're doing here, running the risk of telling these parents you have to do a homeschool, and they may end up in the second grade just because they had that year, and that may not be an appropriate placement. So, you know, and then I also look at the fact that our attendance at first and second grade is almost identical, so I'm not sure what problem we are trying to fix here. If those who are starting, we currently have most kids starting at 6, some starting at 7, but they track on through the system appropriately. So I'm not sure that's necessarily a problem willing to be fixed here. And, you know, and we will have discussions about full day K and all those things. I know in the case of my first grader, she's in the appropriate place at age 6 in first grade. Last year when she was 5, I think half day K was maxing her out, you know. So, but that shouldn't I have some discretion in that as the parent as to what's appropriate for my child? And my fear is, and there may clearly there are some parents out there who are not as engaged with their children as they should be, and I fully understand that. But I'm not sure that this necessarily gets us there. I know the bill's going to pass, but I have, Madam Chair, in all due respect, I have concerns with where we're going here.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, if the Chair wants to move the bill today, I would support that. But let me just put one caveat, a concern that I would have on, I think, further discussion on it, is that because early childhood education is very, very important, and we made that understanding from all the research, but I think it is also important as to when those different levels of education, when those participate in, ideally we'd like to have everybody participate because their child is ready and they can avail themselves of that opportunity. What I think of the part and parcel to early childhood education is because of the fast development and how much happens. I mean, every 6 months at this age, there is a significant difference between 3 and 4 and 4 and 5 and 5 and 6 and 6 and 7. And when I think of, say, 6-year-old starting first grade, which is traditionally most, and we've already heard that most will in fact start first grade, the child who is born, like Mike's myself in August, who just turned 6 then, you know, I could see a July or an August child or a September child who at the start of the year has just turned 6, that maybe there would be some situations in which maybe the homeschool isn't an option. They really want them to be part of the public school system, but isn't quite ready for that because they've barely reached that threshold and would like to take a little bit longer to do that. And that's why I would say I do support the concept of it, of the bill, and would support, Madam Chair, moving it forward. I would prefer the language say something to the degree that at the start of the school year that they have achieved, you know, 6 years and 6 months, you know, so that you don't have those children who've just barely reached that threshold. But that may just be, you know, splitting hairs at this point, and so, you know, your desires, you know, we'll follow that through, but I would like to have that discussion continue as the bill moves through.
Okay, and I think what I'm going to do is there is a fiscal on this bill, so I've heard some comments today. What I'd like to do is if you could withdraw your motion, Senator Cruz, to move the bill today.
Madam Chair, I withdraw my motion.
Okay, thank you. He's withdrawn his motion, so we're going to hold this bill for the fiscal. That way I'll be able to talk with you all about your thoughts, but my inclination is to move this bill. And we can get hundreds and hundreds of email. We'll continue to get hundreds and hundreds of email. They all sound the same. They're all written the same. They all say the same message. But that's just part of the job of being a legislator. I just think having early childhood education is critical, and I don't really see that this infringes upon anyone's rights. So that's where I am, and I will close the work session on this, and we'll bring it back as soon as we get the fiscal. Thank you all. Okay, we are going to catch up some time here. Ms. Soliday, I'd like you to come forward. We're going to open an informational hearing on the Common School Fund. And we've got that scheduled for 20 minutes. We'll probably do that in 15. And introduce yourself and tell us all about what's going on. Bring us up to date.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Louise Soliday, Director of the Department of State Lands, and I'm a former teacher, so just tell me how much time I have and I will cover it.
Well, then that must have been fascinating discussion for you.
First of all, I want to talk about the Common School Fund today, and I'm going to talk about it the two different parts of the Common School Fund as I look at it. We have a financial portfolio and we have a real estate portfolio that we manage that are part of the Common School Fund. The State Land Board, which is the governor, the secretary of state, and the treasurer, serve as the trustees of the Common School Fund under the Oregon Constitution. The financial portfolio is valued as of December 31st of 2006 at just over $1.1 billion. And there's a chart attached to my outline that shows you the history of the growth of the fund itself. The financial portfolio is managed by the Office of the State Treasurer and the Oregon Investment Council, and I can say that we're very pleased with their management of those funds. We've seen significant growth in the last couple of years and anticipated that growth to continue. The financial portfolio is has grown over many years as a result of revenues that have been generated to the Common School Fund from the resources that we manage. And those resources can be divided into three categories. We have revenues from what are called constitutional sources, or our trust lands. And those are the lands that were given to the state at statehood for the purposes of financing a public education system. And at statehood, the state of Oregon received the 13th and the 36th section of each township. That was about 3.4 million acres. And about 6% of the total land base in the state of Oregon. And every state, as they became a state, received land from the federal government for the purposes of financing a public education system. Some of the early states received one section. Oregon received two. Some of the later states actually received four sections. At the time that Oregon was became a state, some of those areas, 13th and 36th sections, had already been settled. And so the federal government was responsible for providing lands in lieu of those original lands that were granted to the states. And I can say that the state of Oregon is still trying to get all of the land that it is owed. We are down to about 3,400 acres that we are owed from the federal government.
That's progress.
From the original allotment. We were at about 5,200 acres last session, and so we've made some progress on that. And we hope to continue to make progress this year, but we are still trying to get all of the land that we were due at statehood.
And Ms. Soliday, we did have to sue for that, did we not?
Madam Chair, we did have to sue for that, and there was a court decision in 1991 that awarded us 5,202 acres, and we have been working ever since. And I've made it my personal goal that by our sesquicentennial in 2009, we actually get all of the land that we're supposed to have gotten at state.
And Ms. Soliday, we're not getting interest on that money or land that we're owed,
Madam Chair,
are we?
I think that's probably correct.
Yeah, we're getting ripped off, basically. Thank you.
As you can imagine, over the years, many of those lands that we originally got were sold, traded, exchanged. Some of them we were swindled out of, and probably the best example of that are swamp lands that really weren't swamp lands. The statute required that in order for somebody to be able to buy swamp land, they had to prove that they could get a boat across it, and people attach boats to wagon trains with horses and dragged boats across dry land and then reported to the state that they had taken a boat across the land and were able to buy that land for a dollar an acre. And there's lots of other sordid, not-so-good actions that took place in Oregon's land history related to our trust lands.
And Ms. Soliday, several folks went to prison over that, if I'm not mistaken, and including public officials.
Madam Chair, that's correct, including a U.S. senator, representative, a state senator, and several other officials who spent time in jail as a result of those activities.
Madam Chair, we're not nearly as corrupt as we used to be.
I guess not. Also included in the constitutional portion of the Common School Fund are proceeds of estates that escheat to the state of Oregon, and those are estates for which there is neither a known heir nor a will. And we hold those funds for 10 years in the event that a rightful heir shows up, and after 10 years they become a permanent part of the Common School Fund. And then we also occasionally get gifts. The most obvious one right now, the governor has dedicated a portion of his salary to the Common School Fund, so we receive a monthly check from him, which is deposited into the Common School Fund, and that becomes part of our constitutional resources that we have.
And we did hear a cell phone go off this morning, so I'm hopeful that a check will be coming to you. And would you, you know, while we're here on the record, could you please tell us where that check would be delivered to?
Madam Chair, that would go to the Department of State Lands, and it can be made payable to the Department of State Lands, and we will deposit it in the Common School Fund.
Thank you very much.
And then we also get revenues from several statutory sources. These are our non-trust lands, and we collect fees, rental payments, royalties, and have sales proceeds. The biggest areas that are part of our statutory lands are our southeast agricultural lands, the former swamp lands, and also our submerged and submersible lands in tidally influenced waterways, navigable waterways, and the territorial sea. We also collect fees through the removal fill program and as well as civil penalties, and we also recover our expenses for managing estates in the event that an heir shows up at some point in the future. And then the third part is unclaimed property. And unclaimed property we hold in trust in perpetuity in the Common School Fund. There's currently a little over almost $254 million in unclaimed property that are sit in the Common School Fund in trust, and we hold those in perpetuity for the rightful owner to come make claim. And as you learned last week, we have some legislators who have unclaimed property sitting in our department, and we've been getting claim forms to all of those legislators over the last couple of weeks so that they can file and get their property returned to them.
And Ms. Soliday, that's also, we had a hearing last week and moved the bill that would take it out of your department and put it in the state treasurer's office.
That's correct. Okay. And that's Senate Bill 67.
Thank you.
The earnings from the Common School Fund are used to make distributions to the 198 school districts across the state of Oregon, as well as to pay the expenses of the constitutional parts of the Common School Fund. You have a chart attached to your materials that shows the history of distributions to school districts. The one piece of good news, I will say, we are about to update and increase the projection for the 2007-2009 biennium. We had projected actually a decrease, and we're now going to project an increase and fairly substantial increase in distributions to school districts for 07-09, and you'll hear more about that later this week. The distributions are the State Land Board has established a formula for making those distributions, and on the blue sheet in your packet I've attached the policy that the Land Board has adopted, and on the back of that is actually the sliding scale that they use to make the distribution determinations from the Common School Fund. And the sort of the underlying principle behind that distribution formula is that we want to retain some of the earnings in the fund to allow it to continue to grow while we distribute as much of the funds as we can out of that out of those earnings each biennium. So that's the sort of the financial side. On the real estate side, we have a real estate portfolio that's valued somewhere between $682 million and $899 million, and we believe that's a fairly conservative estimate. We have about 2.3 million acres of land that we manage, both the trust and the non-trust lands. We manage forest lands, agricultural lands, range lands, industrial, commercial, and residential lands, special stewardship lands, waterways, and mineral and energy resources. And we also manage an additional 2.1 million acres worth of mineral rights that are the mineral rights on lands owned by other state agencies, so land owned by DAS or the Department of Forestry or other state agencies which own lands around Oregon. All of those lands are managed under a constitutional management, constitutional mandate under Article 8, Section 5, Sub 2, which says that we are to manage our lands with the object of obtaining the greatest benefit for the people of this state, consistent with the conservation of the resource under sound techniques of land management. So we have a bit of a balancing act to do. We do believe our fiduciary responsibilities come first, but we also have to put it in the context of sound stewardship of the lands that we are charged with managing. We have developed an asset management plan. We were one of the first states in the nation who actually developed an asset management plan that directs how we manage our real estate portfolio. The first one was adopted in 1995 by the Land Board. We just adopted a new 10-year plan in October, and you all will be getting copies of that. We're sending it out to all of the legislators along with a couple of other annual reports. So you'll be getting a copy of that, but it directs how we are going to manage this real estate portfolio to try and maximize the revenues into the Common School Fund from those lands. And I would say probably the most significant change in this asset management plan from the previous one is to begin to manage the real estate in a more aggressive manner in order to increase the revenues that are coming off of those lands.
I have a question, and I'll have you, Ms. Holliday. Some of that more aggressive management, we've had a conversation about this because I've, you know, other states are doing this. They're doing a public-private partnership where they may lease the land and build a resort and, you know, work that way. Are we looking at doing things like that?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, we are. We are, part of what we're doing through our in-lieu land selections is trying to pick up properties that we believe are in what we call the path of progress. And so most of those selections that we've made have been out in central Oregon in the area between Bend and Redmond. And we, one of our in-lieu selections back in 1995 was what we call the Stevens Road Track, which is just on the northeast side. I always have to think coming from the East Coast, which is east and west. On the
best
northeast,
is the ocean.
Yeah, exactly. Well, where I lived, grew up, east was the ocean.
Ocean,
so
right.
I have to think about that. On the northeast side of the city of Bend, a very small portion of it is in the urban growth boundary. We expect that the remainder of it, it's a 640-acre parcel, is likely to come in to the urban growth boundary during the next expansion, which they've already started. And that's a parcel where we've already done a master plan for mixed-use development, and we would expect that we would be partnering with developers and trying to find ways that we may sell part of the land, we may develop part of the land ourselves into commercial and industrial space so that we continue to accrue revenues to the Common School Fund. And we have other lands where we're looking to do the same thing.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a technical one, Louise. Is there a difference between mineral rights and mining rights?
Madam Chair and Senator Cruz. Sorry.
And I'm thinking specifically a lot of the rights ODOT has for aggregate.
Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, the resources, the aggregate sites that are permitted by Dogami, we do not collect royalties on unless they are on state-owned lands.
Okay, so there is a distinction there.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And you're getting a nod from the back.
Yeah, I had to think that through, but I got there.
Yes.
Louise, have we come to any resolution on the Huntington Road
partial yet?
Madam Chair and Senator Westland, this is what we refer to as the Deschutes Market Road Track, which is a 640-acre parcel that is on our list of lands that we are trying to get from the Bureau of Land Management to complete the in-lieu land selections. We have not come to any final resolution. As I committed to you during the interim, we are looking at the Lapine properties that are available and doing a side-by-side comparison, and we are not completed with that work yet.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. And then the last point I want to make, and it's a very important one, we do manage all the lands and the financial portfolio as a fiduciary. We owe our loyalty to the trust. That means that the resources have to be managed to benefit the K-12 school system in Oregon. The department can't take actions that benefit or favor students today at the expense of future generations of students. And it also means that we can't sell off assets to benefit current students to the detriment of future generations. Nor can we give away land or sell or lease land at less than fair market value. So we take that fiduciary responsibility very seriously, and we do see our job as maximizing revenues into the Common School Fund for the purposes of financing public education. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Just, Ms. Soliday, I just want to be clear that the corruption we saw in the early years was a long time ago, and we've not seen anything like that in the Common School Fund since. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I believe that's the case, and I would hope it would continue to be the case forever.
It was in the early days of Oregon's history, before just around statehood, and it was pretty shocking. And yes, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've noticed on the 03-05 actuals that the forest revenue was $34 million plus, and the forestry costs were about 32% of that. And I guess my question is, I don't understand forest land management costs, but 32% seems like a high charge, and I'm wondering if in fact that is normal and customary, or if it seems high.
Madam Chair and Senator Morris, the Department of Forestry manages our forest lands for us under an interagency agreement, and those costs have tended to run in the 30 to 35% range. There was a study done back in the late 90s that took a look at those costs relative to the cost of managing private forests. The private forest land management comes in the 25-28% range, and so I think the land board was comfortable as long as we kept those Department of Forestry costs within the 30 to 35% range, given the public nature of that operation, that it was a reasonable cost. So that's tended to be the historic number.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I sort of salmon-colored sheet, it does show you for the 03-05 biennium all the sources of revenue that came in, the amounts, and all the expenditures. And on the back is an explanation of the sort of the things I went through in terms of the constitutional statutory revenues and unclaimed property. And we call it the lake diagram, and it's a good visual in terms of how money comes into the Common School Fund and how it goes out.
And Ms. Soliday, if anyone wanted to learn more about Oregon's history in the Common School Fund, are there books available in the library to do that?
Madam Chair, there are. There's a great book. I got the name of it. Hang on a second. Which is entitled, maybe I don't have it with me. There are several resources. There's a graduate student who did a dissertation, which is part of the congressional record, which we have a copy of. But there's a book that's...
I bet Ms. Holman knows it.
It's a little bit hard to find on that. I'm Jeanette Holman from the Department of State Lands. It's a little bit hard to find, but I believe the State Library has a copy, and it's called Looters of the Public Domain.
That's right.
Looters of the what?
Looters.
Of the public domain.
And it was written in jail by one of the participants in the land trust.
And the dissertation was fascinating. I highlighted the heck out of that reading. It was done in, I think, 1931 or something like that.
And, Madam Chair, if anybody wants to copy that, we actually have that at the office. So.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Okay. I appreciate it. I'll close the informational hearing on the Common School Fund, which is always a delight to learn about. We are going to try to bump through this agenda very quickly. I'm just going to pop around. I just saw the Treasurer's Office come in, so I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 381 because I think we can do that one pretty quickly. Colleagues, that's a bill I introduced to put some parameters on the Oregon Investment Council. If you don't mind, I'll just stay right here and talk to you about it. The Oregon Investment Council invests all of Oregon's assets, well, not the Common School Fund assets, but we invest the assets, and the Oregon Investment Council does a great job. They invest in PERS and PERS portfolio and SAFE's portfolio. And I just like to make sure that we have people representing the state of Oregon who actually live in Oregon. There were some concerns about one of the past members of the council not even having a home in Oregon or even residing here. And my hope is that when we appoint people to serve on boards and commissions that represent our state, that they must be residents of the state of Oregon and remain so. And if they aren't, then they shouldn't be serving in that capacity. That's why I brought the bill forward. I think Ms. Richardson is here to testify on behalf of the Treasurer's Office and Bob Livingston also. So why don't you both come up at the same time so we can punch through this. And while you're doing that, Ms. Richardson's going to tell us more about the bill that I didn't tell you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is carried over from our last meeting. Senate Bill 381 requires members of the Oregon Investment Council to have resided in Oregon for at least 6 consecutive months immediately prior to appointment. It would rescind the appointment if the member ceases to be an Oregon resident, and it has some provisions for coming in and out as far as vacation and, you know, reasonable periods of absence from the state. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Richardson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kate Cooper Richardson, Chief of Staff for the State Treasurer. We're just here not with a position on this bill per se. We're here to say it doesn't affect any members currently on the Oregon Investment Council. We don't feel that this is a strong qualification for service on the council. However, it does, we call it the Warren Buffett prohibition, in that if we did have an outside or someone outside the state that had high qualifications, they, and Warren Buffett called us, they wouldn't be able to serve on the investment council. But we're not here to oppose it either.
Ms. Richardson, the investment council are volunteers, correct? They're not paid?
They're not paid.
So the investments are not professionally managed in terms of the council, correct?
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, there are qualifications to serve on the council with background in investment and management, and I think the member that you're referring to did have an investment management firm in the state of Oregon, lived across the river, and so we do have qualifications that and that the governor's office uses. The governor appoints, so this is, the treasurer does not appoint, but there are qualifications in statute for, and we'd actually eventually like to see those qualifications extend to all the members of the council, but we didn't bring that forward.
Well, you have this bill, and you could amend into my bill if you wish. Senator Cruz has a question.
No, I just comment. I have it on pretty good information that Warren Buffett will not be calling.
Okay. All right. Mr. Livingston, tell us what you're here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
About.
For the record, Bob Livingston representing the Oregon State Firefighters Council. And while we certainly are members of the PERS Coalition hasn't taken an official stance with respect to this bill. However, having said that, I think I come here seeking some questions and maybe asking for a little debate with respect to, as you contemplate this bill, one of the things that we feel strongly about is clearly the OIC has been one of the most outstanding investment the council
schools, not only just here in Oregon, but throughout the United States. They have one of the best, if not the best, track records with respect to investing monies that can be found. And so one of the things that certainly we would hope that, I guess it's maybe a poor adage, but if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And so certainly one of the things that I hope that you would contemplate on this is that while certainly I think you need to make some decisions with respect to whether they should be Oregonians or not, I think an overarching question that you must ask yourself is that shouldn't we have the most qualified, try to reach out to find the best qualified people, not so much whether they're Oregonians, but whether they're really good with respect to knowledge, skills, and abilities when it comes to investment. Clearly, many Oregonians, the state of Oregonian, rely on the Oregon Investment Council to do good things, and particularly now with some of the PERS reforms, with the individual account program, there's many Oregonians alike that really rely on them for part of their pension to do an outstanding job. And so certainly when you have a track record like they have in the past, it makes us a little bit nervous that we're going to limit ourselves to individuals that reside within Oregon. Clearly, we're in a global economy. Investments are not only here in Oregon, but nationwide and throughout the globe. And so sometimes one could make the argument that having people with outside experience in those does make for a better portfolio of individuals on the committee. Some other thoughts to think about with respect to this bill. Maybe it's a poor analogy, but I think it's an appropriate one. Measure 45, the one that dealt with the Supreme Court by regions, certainly the voters said that probably wasn't a good idea. And I think this bill is a little bit analogous, that let's not hamstring ourselves with respect to that, and at least let's answer those questions on how it's going to impact whether they can continue to do a good performance on that. I certainly don't have the answers, and maybe we're worrying about nothing, but I think I would hope that you would open a dialogue and deliberate on that as this legislative body on that. One other comment, and then I'll close, is that clearly we've already done, and this body has already done things to make sure that there are some investments here in Oregon. I think it was either last session or the session before. There's requirements that this body has requested that there's venture capital that has to be invested here in Oregon, and so we've already done some things, I think, to make sure that there's a home field with the OIC on what they do. But I think the overarching and the final thought would be, let's make sure we're not doing something that's going to be the detriment of the thousands of Oregonians in the state that relies on the OIC for just a yeoman's job that they do. With that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Appreciate you allowing me to make these comments. And like I said, I just hope we can answer these questions before we move this bill forward, and maybe we would feel a little bit better about it. Thank you very much.
So, Mr. Livingston, let me ask you a question. I guess it's a great quote to call this a Warren Buffett prohibition. I mean, the guy makes money. That's what he does. He doesn't invest in anything that doesn't make him money. But is that serving the state? I mean, I guess you'd want Warren Buffett on your investment council, maybe. Let's take a state, New York. Do we want someone who lives in New York serving on the Oregon Investment Council, making decisions about Oregon's investments and what's right for Oregon when they live in New York?
Madam Chair, committee members, my answer would be I really don't care where they come from as long as they perform. And the reality of it is I don't care if they're in New York or Oregon as long as they're serving the interest of the members that I represent and myself, who's going to rely on the OIC to continue to perform well. And as long as it doesn't upset the apple cart, I'm okay. But the bottom line is it's track record.
Okay. Question by Senator Metzger.
Thank you. Ms. Richardson, could you give us a capsule summary of the role of the OIC board members as it relates then to the investment managers as it relates to the investment? So we have a good understanding of what actual role they play in that continuum of investment.
Certainly, Madam Chair, Senator Metzger. The Oregon Investment Council sets the policy, the investment policy. They're not making the individual investment decisions. As you may know, we have $75 billion now under management. And the PERS fund itself is the granddaddy there. And it's in the high 68 billion right now. We're actually ranked as one of the top funds, public or private, in the nation. So we're kind of bigger than our small state. Our fund is one of the largest and most prestigious out there. It continues to perform at the highest levels. And the Investment Council is responsible for developing the policy of the asset allocation mix for the various funds according to the purpose of each fund. So to meet the requirements of the SAFE fund, there are particular asset allocations and decisions that need to be, policies that need to be set for that fund to achieve the goals that fund was created to do. Same with the PERS fund, looking at all the different requirements that PERS has to meet its obligations, the Oregon Investment Council develops policy specifically for that fund. Same with the financial portfolio of the Common School Fund. It makes asset allocation investment policy decisions to provide guidance for our professional managers, and we work with scores of investment professionals and higher managers to manage all these, to make the specific decisions, and with our investment professionals as well. So their job is to go up at the top level and make the investment decisions on the best information that they can gather from our professional staff, from the consultants it hires, from their own knowledge, and they are required, qualified by training and experience in the field of investment or finance, to take all those things and then develop a policy that provides guidance. And an example of how the Investment Council has done that, we think, to the great, well, obviously, I think the numbers show that. The Investment Council was one of the first public funds to move into equities, into the public equities market. And that actually, we were very much a trendsetter for public investment funds in that way. And that really brought a lot of additional return and growth to our fund. Same thing in some of the private equity areas. We've been a leader in that way. And that is through the decisions of the Oregon Investment Council and their knowledge and expertise and the policy guidance that they've given to the investment professionals that they hire. And they hire those investment professionals, the managers that go out and make the individual investment decisions with their slice of the pie.
And can I ask one other question, Madam Chair? And then I don't know if you have this information available, but do you have a 20-year look back in terms of members of the OIC, in terms of how many members would have been disqualified from this bill? In other words, have we had out-of-state members in the last 20 years who have been guiding this great performance, or have they all been Oregonians?
Madam Chair, Senator Metzger, no, we haven't done that. We have had members, as the chair mentioned, we have had a member who had a home, and I believe, frankly, we have never asked anyone where they actually reside. And, of course, the appointing authority is the governor, so we take who the governor appoints. As I look back, I believe that most have been Oregon residents.
You're welcome. Any other questions? Thank you for your testimony. I'm going to close the public hearing. And I'm not going to take this into work session because I want to talk to Ms. Richardson about the other issues she raised early in her testimony. So we will move on. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 318, because I would like to get that one moving today. Ms. Richardson, can you update us on that? And we'll see who's signed up to testify.
Madam Chair, this is a bill that was heard last Friday in Reed's Port. Would you like me to summarize the measure again, or just I can?
You can summarize the measure and that we did hear from a number of folks.
Senate Bill 318 would modify the types of grants that may be awarded to school district. It requires school districts applying for grants to fund 25% or more of grant activities. It removes the intent statement linking the School Improvement Fund to Quality Education Commission recommendations. It directs the Department of Education to establish monetary rewards for school districts and programs that show extraordinary progress towards student achievement goals. declares an emergency and would take effect July 1st, 2007. We do have three amendments as well, which I can speak to now or later.
No, I'd actually like you to do that now because I think the folks who are going to testify can speak to the amendments perhaps. So explain our amendments, if you would.
Three amendments. The dash one amendment retains the intent statement linking the School Improvement Fund to Quality Education Commission recommendation. The dash three amendment specifies that school improvement funds may be used for monetary rewards program, and I can explain that further if needed.
The dash one comes from me. The dash three comes
Is in response to a concern brought up by revenue and the lack of clarity regarding how the funds would be distributed and between the grants and the monetary rewards program. So it's designed to clarify how those would be divvied up within the school improvement fund.
Okay, so it's a technical fix to our bill,
yes,
basically.
Yes.
Okay. And then the dash four?
The dash four removes the requirement for applying school districts to fund 25% or more of grant activities.
And that one is also my amendment, based on what we heard in Reedsport. So we'll get to the amendments soon. Let's hear some testimony from Lori Wimmer-Whalen and Chuck Bennett, the dynamic duo. They are a dynamic duo of colleagues because they got together yesterday with a work group and solved that auditing bill and are going to come back and have it all fixed up for us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for your record. Lori Wimmer-Whalen with the Oregon Education Association, wearing my cape and tights under my street clothes. I'm here in support of this bill, Senate Bill 318, as it will be amended, I am hopeful. We have been part of a coalition that we started in August, and that coalition includes all of the education groups you all are typically seeing in this building, the OEA, OSEA, AFT Oregon, PTA, Stand for Children, COSA, OSBA, Small Schools, ESDs, the whole gamut. We're all working together this session in an unprecedented way, and we are working together both on the funding-related issues for K-12 and also the policy issues, particularly those that impact student achievement. And we see that Senate Bill 318 is the centerpiece of our efforts to target student achievement initiatives over and above the state school fund. And we were also in support of this bill when it originally passed back in 2001 and was funded for half the biennium before the recession hit. And as we all know, the state went through quite a bit of cutbacks over five special sessions, and this was an early casualty of that time period. But we think now that the economy is back on the upswing, it's time to revisit that particular fund, which does have it targets student achievement in a way that's consistent with the elements of policy as advised in the quality education model, and it tracks it very closely, and that's why we support it. This bill was passed as a bipartisan, bicameral, consensus-type bill with all education advocates supporting it originally, and I believe that that's essentially the same way to describe this bill, which updates it for today's initiatives. We contemplate that ultimately the 2007-09 biennium would include a $6 billion state school fund investment as well as a $300 million targeted investment through this bill. And the way we believe it works is that it gives both policy direction with respect to the best practices for enhancing student achievement, but to do so in a way that retains something very essential, which is local control. A school district will know whether their first, best, most urgent strategy is to deal with extra resources for an abnormally large ELL population, for example, or whether it would be better to target early learning initiatives, literacy programs, full-day kindergarten, or what have you. There's enough flexibility in this fund so that that school district could make that critical decision and apply for those grant monies accordingly and spell out not only what they intend to use them for, but what kind of results they think they can do in one school year in order to get the second year of the grant. So we believe that it has internally some accountability and consistency as well. We participated with the Senate Excellence Education Commission's work in this last interim, as several of you did as well, and as several and two of my members, Kelvin Calkins, who's the regional vice president of the Oregon Education Association, and Alan Bruner, who's on our board of directors and was last year's Teacher of the Year. So I think that we've had some good minds at the table creating this. We do support the amendments because we feel that, first of all, the 25% language is $75 million that we would expect the school districts to come forward with, which kind of defeats the purpose of having this additional funding for this targeted investments. And we also, of course, prefer that the link remain solid with the quality education model because that is what identifies the best practices that we would hope school districts would employ to raise those student achievement numbers. Now, I have for you something I'll give you all. It's a chart that we put together when we were first working as a coalition to take a look at all of the policy elements that you could find that were rolling around that we knew of, to match them against the quality education models policy elements and also the school improvement funds policy elements, which are all parallel. And then we showed how our coalition's policy elements also track with all of those. And those of both the governor and the chalkboard project are also included on this chart so that you can read across for those items that have consensus. We think it's really important that the legislature not cherry pick any single one initiative for a statewide mandate, but rather to leave that flexibility in because some districts are already doing some of the things that you might like to see schools do. Some aren't, and they would deploy their resources elsewhere. An example of that is Hood River chose early on to go to a full day kindergarten program. And other things came off the table. Other sacrifices were made so that they could put their resources there. So for them, a statewide mandate, for instance, on full-day kindergarten would not be terribly helpful because they're already doing it. Having the school improvement money available, though, enables them to take their share of the grant and deploy it back to buy back maybe one of those programs that hit the floor as a result of choosing full-day kindergarten. So that's how we see the hydraulic working with this bill. I think that's pretty much everything except to say that we have a brochure that is about to come off the press that identifies all of the policy elements that our coalition supports, which track with this bill and has a little bit more detail on it. And the per student funding level, $300 million, for example, is only $208 a kid. So if you look at this the way you would a restaurant menu, you know, you don't order everything on the menu for dinner, at least I don't. This will show you on a per student basis how much each of those elements would cost. So that really helps you understand what the choices are with respect to this bill and to policy. And we will make a copy of this available right now to the committee, and everyone will get one as soon as it comes off the press. With that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Ms. Wilmer Whalen, do you have the chart that you have the check marks?
I love stuff like that. And I want to thank Senator Metzger for chairing the Senate Commission on Educational Excellence where we develop these policies. And we had hoped to have Gretchen Holt-Pierce this morning to testify, and she wasn't available, and it was important to get this bill moving. But the 25% idea, we heard testimony in Reedsport, those of us who were able to attend, that for the cash-strapped, very poor districts, that was absolutely an onerous hurdle for them that they couldn't overcome. So that's why you're supportive of that amendment.
Right. Okay. Thank you. And Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was also at that. I guess, Ms. Wilmer Whalen, I want to say this for the record and see if you concur. Section 2, sub D of the bill, line 26, where, because I do like the list, it's mentoring, teacher attention, and professional development. It's my understanding, and the chair says it will be addressed in other legislation, but for the purpose of this list, I'm assuming mentoring isn't just teacher mentoring. It could be mentoring of principals. It could be mentoring in a bigger picture than, and I know we all agree on that. I'm just saying this for the record. And
Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, that's absolutely our understanding as well.
Okay, thank you.
And I did want to point out, too, because I had a question. I'm a big supporter of the Sun School program that Portland has, and we did submit that flexibility in here for that. And I also, Senator Metzger had wanted Voc Tech programs, and I think that we wrote this pretty broadly to be pretty flexible. Is that not correct?
Yes, Madam Chair, it is. We're hoping that that this wouldn't be as prescriptive as it is directional.
Okay, great. Yeah, that's a good phrase. Mr. Bennett.
Madam Chair, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. I really don't have anything to add to Ms. Wimmer Whalen's testimony and the comments from the committee. I'm sort of exhibit two of the of Ms. Wimmer Whalen's testimony that there is a coalition, and I'm part of the face of that coalition. But we do strongly support Senate Bill 318, and particularly are pleased with the amendments that you've decided. We hope you will add to it. Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Bennett, and I'm really glad that all of you have come together and you're working so well together. I felt that we needed to stay consistent with what the Quality Education Commission was set up to do and its intent, and that's why I added that back in. So thank you. Any questions of these two? Okay, great. Thanks very much. Next up, I would like to hear from Brian Reeder from the Department of Ed, and then after that, we'll hear from Greg Peden and John Pagna. Oh, man, I probably butchered that, but Brian, take it away.
Thank you, Chair Walker, members of the committee. I will be very brief because given the testimony of both Ms. Wimmer Whalen and Mr. Bennett, I don't really have much to add. I do have a couple places in the bill where the language we felt was a bit ambiguous and maybe would suggest a technical correction. One of them had to do with the matching program, and since the one of the amendments would eliminate that requirement, I won't address that issue.
Okay.
But on line 27 on the first page, the reference to student retention, I assume that means, in this context, dropout prevention as opposed to retaining students in grade level. Perhaps some clarity on that language might be helpful.
I do remember that discussion, and that
okay. That
is student retention is encompassing lowering the dropout rate.
Okay.
And if anyone has any remembrance different than that, please. Okay, Ms. Wimmer Whalen is shaking no, and she was involved in the accountability work group.
Okay, good enough.
Where this was. So that's what that is.
And then the only other item would be on page 2 on line 3. It makes a reference to improving a student achievement gap, and again, by that we assume we mean reducing the achievement gap. That may be a little clearer word to use in that context. Other than that, the department would support the amendments and support the bill.
Okay, I appreciate that. So programs to improve a student achievement gap between student groups, you'd rather have that, say, reduce a student achievement gap? Is there any comment?
I don't know how anyone would read improve to mean increase the achievement gap, but I'm always in favor of going right to the direct word you really mean, and
okay.
In this case I think we mean reduce the achievement gap. A minor point, but I'll throw that out for your consideration.
Well, someone who cares about language and grammar and all that, I appreciate that you're concerned about it. And I do want to move the bill today. It is my intent to move this bill today.
Then I'll shut up.
Well, you don't need to do that, but we might be able to get away with. Oh, no, I've been given. You know what? I think I'd like to move the bill today, and if that's still troubling you, we can change that over in the House, just because I'm tired of having this bill sit around, and I want to make something happen.
Okay.
And I appreciate your testimony. Thank you. Next, I'll hear from Greg Peden and John Topogna. Did I do better that time?
Topogna.
There we go. And you've testified before, so I should know, but Topogna, very nice.
First.
All right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Greg Peden. I'm here today representing the Chalkboard Project. John is the managing partner with Echo Northwest, the economic consulting firm that's doing work with us. In the spirit of time, John's a bit pinched for time this morning. I'm going to paraphrase my written comments that are being handed out to you right now. We appreciate the opportunity to share our views on this bill, and we applaud the Senate Excellence Commission's work on this effort. We support the idea of new funds for schools being targeted to reforms based on research and student outcomes. Many of Chalkboard's reform proposals are included in this bill, although we would favor an approach that more tightly connects the dollars to the student achievement gains that Oregonians would like to see. The over 100,000 Oregonians that have participated in the Chalkboard process believe reform should accompany any new spending. Specifically, our work with the public and in reviewing best educational practice research has led us to conclude that a more targeted grant program will yield higher student achievement gains in the long run. Specifically, we would encourage you to prioritize proven reforms within this program in three key areas. First, early age initiative grants. Second, quality educator grants. And third, additional improvement grants targeted to middle and high school and full day kindergarten. So just to paraphrase the rest of my written testimony, early age initiative grants, we think priority should be put on first grade and kindergarten and first grade in reducing class size. We think a strengthening of mentoring and targeting teacher and administrator professional development ought to be a priority. And then we would prioritize additional grants targeted at middle and high school to implement education practices defined or identified by the superintendent of public instruction and the quality education model as demonstrating a highly likelihood of success. With that, I'll ask John to do his piece.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, John Taponia, managing director with Echo Northwest, and I have consulted to the Chalkboard Project as a client since the spring of 2004. I am going to work through this PowerPoint very quickly. I have two members of the audience who are eager to get back to school today. In any event, on the first piece, first of all, let me say that this bill sets up a very strong framework as Oregon reinvests in education and makes a step back toward the national average. If you look on this first page, what this is showing is current expenditures in K-12 expressed as a share of the economy, total personal income in Oregon since 1989-90 school year. And you can see the blue line is Oregon. Going back into the early 90s, we were spending about 5% of the economy on K-12 current expenditures. Then with the implementation of property tax limitations, that was pulled down to the national average at a little bit over 4% in the mid-90s. We then bumped up a little bit, but then the current or the most recent financial setback for the state, we then fell behind again in most recent years. So the fundamental question that I think the Senate Commission faced and that this legislature faces over the course of the next several months is, as Oregon thinks about taking a step back toward investing more in line with the national average and maybe at some point above it, how does it do that? Does it do it in a very broad way, or does it focus and target? And the Senate bill is moving in the direction of some of those additional funds being targeted to particular areas. And our notion is that there would be some additional prioritization within that as well. This next chart is simply making a point that additional expenditures can improve achievement, but more resources don't necessarily guarantee better outcomes. And this is a back and forth between two prominent economists, Princeton's Alan Krueger and Stanford's Eric Hanischek, looking at the exact same 41 studies that attempted to link dollars to achievement outcomes. And you can see the blue bars are Kruger's interpretations of those 41 studies. The red bars are Hanischek's interpretations of the same 41 studies. Kruger looked at the studies and said, on balance, I'd say about 51% of the conclusions were positive. Hanischek looked at the same studies and said about 27% of the findings were positive. So you can see the same two relatively sharp economists drawing different conclusions. But I think the big point that comes out of this is that there is a fair amount of agreement that dollars can make a difference, but they don't always make a difference. And even Alan Kruger, who's generally in favor of expanding expenditures on K-12, would admit that. So that then moves me to the fundamental question on the next page for the 2007 legislature. As Oregon begins a move back to the national average in K-12 spending, should policymakers target the resources? And if so, how? And I think that's the central point that's embedded in Senate Bill 318. If we move to the next page, rigorous experiments support only a handful of K-12 best practices. And this is some of the same testimony that I gave to the Senate Commission earlier this year. When the Coalition on Evidence-Based Policy, a number of sharp academics got together in 2003 and looked across the vast expanse of education literature, they could only identify four broad practices that they would say rose to the level of having solid, rigorous academic backing in terms of a practice linked to achievement. Those were one-on-one tutoring by qualified tutors for at-risk readers in grades 1 through 3, reducing class sizes in early grades, and then some instructional techniques, life skills trainings for junior high students to reduce smoking and substance abuse, and instruction for early readers in phonemic awareness and phonics. It's not that there aren't many other practices out there that do make a difference. It's that the research community and educators haven't got together and measured them in an appropriate way for us to go to the bank with. That the research community in education is much less developed than it is, frankly, in the medical field or even welfare to work, where there's many, many experimental studies on how do we get welfare recipients back into the labor force and does this approach work better than the other. Randomized controlled experiments that policymakers can rely on. So now I'll move to the chart that says why so few best practices in K-12 education. Just a couple of quotes. The first from the Coalition on Evidence-Based Policy in 2003. Again, the general consensus from there is it's just that the research community has let us down, and or the education policymakers haven't set up policies to be evaluated. They will try to implement many things at once, and at the end of the day, you don't know which of those many things drove the achievement gain or didn't. And then Hanischek's take on this in a paper that's has a disturbing title, What If There Are No Best Practices? His general conclusion would be that there's such a constellation of teacher quality, of teacher attributions, and student needs that really what you have to do is set up a good system, and good teachers will find the appropriate practices for their particular student needs. So that leads us then, after having sifted through all of that, and there's vast reports on the Chalkboard website that backs up all of this, to Chalkboard's investment priorities on the next page. And those are kindergarten and first grade class size reductions. Tutors for kindergarten through third grade students who are falling behind in reading, and mentors for new teachers and principals. So those, again, priorities within the list that you have identified. All of those are in here. I think getting back to a term that was used in earlier testimony, I think it's a notion of direction within this bill and encouragement to prioritize some of these that have a little better evidence in the academic area than some others. So now a couple of pages on why these particular priorities, for example, why prioritize class size reductions for kindergarten and first grade as opposed to second and third grade. And here's a quote from the Project STAR in Tennessee, which is the core of class size reduction research. It is the largest true experiment that has been run in the class size area. And in Tennessee STAR's final report, they noted that they saw gains In kindergarten and first grade that grew, those gains were maintained in second and third grade for those students that remained in small classes, but they didn't continue to increase, so there was an additional boost for the small classes, at least through their measurement. So again, if you're looking at the class size reduction, it appears that the evidence out of 10th grade, which is the best area, would say that your evidence is stronger in kindergarten and first grade, not quite as strong in second and third. Why caution on the next page? Why caution major expansions in full-day kindergarten? There are a number of recent studies that have come out that have said that while you may have some gains through full-day kindergarten that show up at the end of the kindergarten year, those gains do not appear to be sustained in subsequent years at the end of first grade or thereafter.
Well, and we'll be looking for that testimony when we get to the kindergarten bill later this session,
okay.
And that's why we have it as in our bill here
okay.
as an option.
Senator Cruz. Madam Chair, just an opinion, and I don't think you have statistics, because as I've looked at that, I've questioned it as well. But one of the reasons I'm an advocate for fully funding Head Start is that's dealing with kids that probably need more assistance on the front end rather than the general population. And do you think we can track the gain in Head Start through the rest, or does that diminish as well? Or do you know that?
There's a whole host of literature on a variety of early childhood interventions, some more expensive than others, but the evidence there is strong in the early ages, pre-kindergarten. A lot, relatively more literature there and strong literature in the pre-K area.
Mr. Tapanya, we have 8 minutes left. We need to move the bill.
Okay.
Can you just kind of...
I will wrap up. Wrap up with just the general conclusions at the end. First of all, I think the framework of targeted investments is a good one. I would say that the committee should focus on potentially prioritizing within the list that they have. They have a good list. But if you simply throw it out with as many activities and flexibility that you have, my fear would be that 10 years down the road, you won't know whether you have done anything because you have done so many things at once. And so that within this, you try to provide some direction to those areas that have better evidence as measured by academics to date. But generally, a very strong strong bill. I would also emphasize that you should fund well the research aspect of this so that 10 years down the road we can know what these dollars bought.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Any questions? All right, gentlemen, thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing.
I'm just still confused on this bill. Perhaps if Mr. Tapanya could invite his two young learners to the dais to give their ascension to this bill, I'd be a lot more comfortable.
Well,
if they could say it's a good bill, should pass, I'll feel a lot more comfortable in voting for this bill.
All right. I'm going to reopen the public hearing for these two fine, beautiful young children to quickly come forward and introduce themselves and say, good bill should pass, if that's what you so choose.
What?
Senator, you have confused this young man. Young man, what is your name?
Max Tapanya.
Okay, and is this your sister?
Yes. I-S-A-B-L.
Isabel.
Isabel Tapanya. Okay, thank you both for coming. Senator Westland, do you have a question of these children?
Do you think this is a good bill?
What bill?
Don't ask the question if you don't know the answer.
The bill your daddy likes.
What?
The bill your daddy likes.
Yes.
Yes.
All right.
I am much more relieved.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, children. Have a good day at school. I will close the public hearing. I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 318. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Madam Chair. First, I think there was some coercion on that last testimony.
I think so, too. But we won't go there.
Madam Chair, I move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 318.
Senator Cruz moves the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 318. Let me explain that that does restore the language in Section 1. Correct?
Correct.
Yes.
Which is already in the statute. Any conversation, any questions, any discussion? May anyone oppose? Hearing no opposition, the Dash 1 amendment is approved. Senator Cruz.
Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 318.
Thank you. Senator Cruz moves the Dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 318. And colleagues, that takes out that requirement that they have to meet 25%.
No.
I'm sorry. That's the revenue.
LFO 1.
Yeah, okay. That's the LFO 1, the technical change. Okay. Any comments, questions, discussion? Hearing none. Any opposition? Hearing none. Dash 3 is approved.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 4 amendment to Senate Bill 318.
Thank you. Senator Cruz moves the Dash 4 amendment to Senate Bill 318. And if I have that in front of me, which I do,
25%.
That is a 25%. And colleagues, we heard all about that in Reed's Port, and that was it would be a tragic consequence of this bill if we didn't fix that. And any other discussion, comments, or questions about that? Senator Metzger.
Yes, and since Gretchen, Ms. Pierce isn't here, I do want to add on that. There is a reason for that 25%, and I understand and appreciate and acknowledge the difficulty that some districts could have in terms of putting in other funds to this. The purpose of it, or at least one of the major purposes of it, was just to make sure that we have sustainable investment in the programs. And so if there is a commitment by a particular school to go a certain direction because they've used some of their funds to make a commitment as opposed to just having the monies available, you know, part of the thing, we want to make sure that the programs do last. And that was, you know, part of the issue in terms of if there was some local commitment using some of their own dollars, that we really think this is a program that wants to be sustained beyond just maybe the grant stage. That's what was the purpose of that. But I appreciate what you learned in Reed's Port that that could be done. I would acknowledge that in the bill now, and I haven't talked to Ms. Pierce about it, but I think she would be supportive of this. Again, it's still the Department of Education that is going to be awarding those grants, and I think with the direction from the legislature, I have confidence the Department of Education will ask those very pointed questions about grant requesters as to their sustainability, their plan, their local commitments to address that issue in a different manner. And so, therefore, I would support the amendment.
Thank you, Senator. And I appreciate that comment and where the original idea came from. Any other questions? Okay. Any opposition to the Dash 4? Hearing none. That's approved. Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 318 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 318 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Comments, questions, concerns, discussion?
Good bill.
Good bill. Great work. Great work by you, Senator Metzger, and Senator Decker for co-chairing the committee. Great work by all of the participants. You were one of them. Please.
Okay. And I support the bill, but I do think the testimony from Chalkboard is illustrative of at some point in time, you know, this isn't a finished product and we'll need to take a new look. And at some point we may decide that it's best to prioritize. But at this point in time, leaving the discretion and the options and the flexibility with the schools on the front end, I think, is appropriate as well, because we will be able to track where the money goes and what they're doing with it and see if our priorities that we think should be match up with what the school districts think their priorities should be as well. So,
I agree with you, Senator. That's the great way of addressing that issue that Chalkboard raised. I think that's very appropriate. Okay. All right. I'm going to take a roll call vote on this one since this is the bill itself. So we'll hear that.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Moore?
Aye.
Senator
Metzger? Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Wilson?
Aye. Wow. Senate Bill 318 received the constitutional majority, now passed on its way to the Senate floor. Senator Metzger, do you and I want to share hearing that
bill?
Okay, thank you. We are going to close the work session on Senate Bill 318. As you can see, we had one bill we didn't get to today. We will carry Senate Bill 218 over to next Tuesday because we have Thursday's agenda already full. And I apologize if you've sat here, but we just didn't anticipate we'd have so much testimony on that first bill. So thank you, committee. Appreciate your attendance. We're closing on time. We'll adjourn.